Start this off. So we are exploring a discourse which was said in 1966. This is a Hasidic discourse, Helen. Yeah. We're not actually going to be looking at the Siddur yet. We'll be coming to that in a little while. So don't close it, then we'll lose the place. So we are really exploring something from this week's Sedra, which at some point will be, if we get there, will be compared with something in the Siddur, which is also from the Torah. So let's just see how this week's Sedra. Now, this week's Sedra is Baha B'chokotai. There are two joined Sedras together, and we're looking here at the second one. Im B'chokotai Telechu. You see that? If you look at the one with English, you've got it there. Helen?
I'm looking. Oh, this one.
Yeah. That's the one we're beginning with.
Yeah.
So God says, Im b'chukotai telechu, if you walk in my statutes, ve'ed mitzvotai tishmeru, and you keep, you guard my commandments, ve'asitem otam, and you do them, ve'natati gishmechem be'itam, then I will give your rain in its season, in its right time. V'natna ha'aretz yevula, and the earth will give its produce. V'eitz ha'sadeh yiten pirio, and the fruit tree and the trees of the field will give their fruit. And it continues about all kinds of positive blessings about how the way there will be peace in the land, and everything will be very positive. And there'll be no problems, right? So that is the beginning of the second parsha, and the discourse is going to quote this verse and then explore it. And what it's particularly going to explore is the whole idea of God promising this kind of reward, this kind of physical reward. You might think it would be more suitable for God to give us spiritual rewards. Why should it be physical rewards of this kind? So that's how the discourse is going to go. Now, a discourse is a very spiritual event. If you could imagine a large hall crowded with people, and then people begin to sing a melody that we're going to sing in a minute. And after that melody, the Lubavitcher Rebbe would teach this discourse in a very beautiful way. It was something very, very profound. And there were people there present who could remember the whole thing. He would teach it on a Shabbat, but there were people who could remember the whole thing word for word, even though it was many pages long when you put it in writing. And they would write it down after Shabbat. So on Shabbat you can't take notes, but after Shabbat they would get together and write it down. And so we have this large library of the Rebbe's teachings, many printed books which contain the Rebbe's teachings, many of which he edited himself later on, like preparing it for publication. But this one he didn't prepare for publication. It's the way it was heard and then transcribed. And just recently people have edited it with nukudot, with the dots, the vowels, and putting a commentary to help it. So now we have the melody, the discourse melody, to help us in our attempt to understand it. Oh ya 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 yo ya yo, ay ya 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 yo, ayamba ya yamba yam bom bom, ayeramba ya yeramba yom ba ho. Ya yeram ba ya ya yo ya yeram ba yam ba yo ha yeram ba yeram ba yo ya ha ya ya yeram bam oh ya yeram bam oh ya ya ho ya ya yo. Right, so now we're looking at the actual discourse. Now we move to the page, which is just in Hebrew. the pages, and that is the discourse that we're going to explore. Did you want to comment?
Of course. A question. The melody that you sang is familiar to me.
Right.
Does the text of the melody that you sang now have a meaning? You start.
Hasidic melodies are often wordless.
All right.
Wordless melodies.
All right. Fine.
So they don't have a text. There are Hasidic melodies which take a verse from the Torah or from Psalms or something like that, or anywhere in the Bible, but in Scripture, or it could be from the Talmud. But many Hasidic melodies are without words
at all.
Thank you
very much.
Right. And the practice of singing wordless melodies apparently began in the 16th century.
Uh-huh.
So among the Kabbalists. So they began the idea in Israel, and they began the idea of singing wordless melodies, and this was taken up by the Hasidic movement 200 years later. Yeah.
I know the melody, and I didn't know whether there was a... Thank you.
Yeah. Right. So here we are in the actual discourse. Im b'chukotai telechu. So the beginning is just repeating what we read in the Torah. If you walk in my statutes, ve'et mitzvotai tishmuru, and you guard my mitzvot, ve'asitem otam, and you do the mitzvot, ve'natati gishmechim be'itam, I will give you rain in its season, and then it continues, ve'olech etchem komamiyot, and I will lead you upright in a healthy and a happy way. But tzarich lahavin, now we have to understand, here's a question being asked. Lama ne'emar kan, lama ne'emru kan, yi'udim gashmiyim, why are we being told here material promises, physical promises? Ve'lo yi'udim ruchaniyim, and not spiritual promises. Surely the Torah and the mitzvot are something so great, you would expect some kind of spiritual promise. And instead, it's very practical that there will be rain and the crops will grow. V'yesh lohosif b'zeh mankanad, dehinei yi'udim gashmiim, physical promises, rewards, nizkeru b'chama mekomot b'Torah, are mentioned in a number of places in the Torah. V'hachidush kan, but here there's a new thing. Husha ha'yehudim ha'gashmiyim, here these promises, these physical promises, heim b'parsha klalit b'Torah. This is not just somewhere in the Torah, this is a central point within the Torah. Sheba medubar odot klalut inyan limud haTorah, because in this section of the Torah that we've just read and the whole section, it's talking about learning Torah, v'kiyum hamitzvot, and keeping the mitzvot. So it's not just that there is a physical benefit from this mitzvah or that mitzvah. Here it's talking in general about the nature of Torah in general, and the importance of learning Torah, and the importance of keeping mitzvah, and here the focus is on physical benefits. Okomo shekatav Rashi beferush im b'chukotai telechu. Rashi is a famous commentator. Does anyone know when he lived?
He lived in France.
Yes.
About 900 or...
A little bit later. So around 1100. Mm-hmm. So in the 11th century. So there we have Rashi. So he like by 11. So Rashi wrote a commentary on the whole Torah. In fact, Rashi wrote a commentary on the whole of Scripture, the whole Hebrew Bible, and also on almost the whole Talmud as well. So he's a very great figure. Now he writes, "Beperush im b'chukotai telechu." When it says, "If you walk in my statutes," he asks there a question. He says, "Yachol ze kiyum hamitzvot." This is line 10. Could this mean keeping mitzvah? Kushehu omer. When it says a few words later, "Ve'et mitzvotai tishmeru," and you keep my mitzvot. This is talking of the second phrase, is talking about keeping mitzvot, keeping the commandments. So what does it mean, walking in my statutes? Right? The first word. If you walk in my statutes and you keep my mitzvah. So the Torah doesn't repeat itself. So it must mean something else. So Rashi is asking, what does it mean? And why is there the double expression? And he gives an explanation which comes from the sages, that the first part, if you walk in my statutes, means shetiyu amelim b'torah, that you make an effort in studying Torah. That making of an effort in studying Torah, that is a powerful step for an individual, for a group of people, for the Jewish people as a whole. That's one thing, making an effort in studying Torah. And the second point is keeping mitzvah. Now, the question is, if here we have a general statement about the Jewish people from God, that if you study Torah, making an effort, and you keep mitzvah, which all implies something very positive, why is it that it's only a physical reward which is being described? Wouldn't we expect something more spiritual? So, for example, the Rambam, Maimonides, comments on why does it say in the Torah physical rewards? Because people are like children. When you are trying to teach a child, you say, listen, you learn the ABC with me, and I'll give you a sweet. So gradually, the child learns to read. Now, eventually, the child is very happy to read and doesn't need to have your sweet, and he or she knows that by reading they can get very enjoyable experiences and be stimulated and inspired and read a poem or write a poem. They don't need the sweet anymore. But at the beginning, you have to persuade them. So the Rambam says that's why there are promises of practical benefits in the Torah. It's just to attract people to begin keeping Torah law in the proper way. But in fact, the real benefits of Torah are way, way beyond anything physical. It's spiritual experience of the most on the highest order. The gazing and being inspired and filled with love at the greatness of the infinite, of the divine. So that's the way the Rambam moves. That's what he's trying to move everyone towards. All right. So that's one question here. Maimonides gives an answer. Here, it gives a different answer. Not the same as Maimonides. So one question here is, why are physical rewards stressed in this section of the Torah, which seems such a central part of the Torah? Now, line 13. V'odzo. Now, further point. Shemigodol ma'alat ha'schar sheniska kan. From the great significance of the reward, which is mentioned here, it's expressed in physical terms, but it's expressed in a very superlative way. Muhach, that proves from a Dubar Khan that we're talking here about Bekiyum HaTorah Mitzvot, about people keeping the Torah and the Mitzvot, but often Na'ale in a very extraordinary way, in a superior way. Would you like a drink of water?
No, I'm drinking this.
Okay. Because our sages say, "Schar mitzvah mitzvah." The reward of a mitzvah is the mitzvah. As Rabbi Shneur Zalman explains, his name, he's called the old Rebbe, the first Rebbe, the Alter Rebbe. So, as he explains in a famous book that he wrote, which is called Tanya, Shemischara neida mehuta umadregata. From the reward of a mitzvah, you realize something about the significance of the mitzvah. V'chevan shehaschar shenizka kan. Since the reward that is mentioned here, hu ba'ofen shelamaylo mehateva. It might be a physical reward, but the way that it's written and the way that it's explained by the sages, it's above nature. Why is it above nature? Kafi shedarshu rabotenu zichronam libracha, as our sages explain. Ala pasuk, they comment on the words, the Eitz HaSadeh Yiten Piryo, the tree of the field will give its fruit. So that sounds like fruit trees, right? The sages say, no, it's not fruit trees. Heini Lanei Tzchak, these are barren trees, non-fruit-bearing trees, which are looked down in the among the sages and the Torah. It doesn't usually talk about trees just for a nice garden, which we might think of them in that way. But in a place where food is a necessity, so a tree bearing fruit is seen on a much higher level than a tree which doesn't bear fruit. So it says that in the future, the barren trees, v'atidin lasot perot, they will in the future bear fruit. So in other words, it's going to be a mysterious thing. It's the nature will change somewhat, and the trees which don't give fruit will give fruit. V'chein dashu ala pasuk v'natati gishmechem be'itam, and also the idea of the rain. I will give the rain in its season. What does it mean in its season? The rabbis comment, b'leile reviyot, on Wednesday nights, u'b'leile shabbatot, and on Friday nights. Now, Friday night is a good time for torrential rain, because normally on Friday night, people aren't going very far. They might go a short distance to the synagogue, but then they come home and they're at home. The travelers who have to walk miles and miles, they're usually at home on a Friday night. So that can be a time that the rain comes in order to water the fields. So that means that the way the sages understand the verses here, they are talking about something practical, but it's in a mystical way. It's in a miraculous way. So there we have from that from the fact that the physical things are expressed in this sort of intense way. We're skipping now. Go down to the last line 26. So this means that this great reward indicates, line 25, the end, al godel godel ma'alat ha'avodah, the greatness of the service, b'kiyum kiyum Torah mitzvot. How great is our effort to keep the Torah, to study Torah and mitzvot, which is also hinted, v'chamru mazgam, which is also hinted, b'mar shekatuv, what it says, b'chukotai telechu, walk in my statutes. B'chukotai daika, meaning specifically my statutes over the page. Shuhu inyan. Okay.
Sorry, Pei, you didn't say what on Wednesdays, though. You said what on Shabbos, but you didn't say what on Wednesdays.
That is a very good point. And I'm not sure whether the... It doesn't explain in the commentary either. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know why. I'm sure there's a reason given why Wednesday night, but there's the Wednesday night and the Friday night. I don't know why the Wednesday night, but so here we have the idea that there's something mysterious taking place. As a result of our keeping of Torah and of mitzvah, it's talking about us getting physical benefits, but the physical benefits are in some kind of mysterious way. They're not just ordinary, practical, physical benefits. Still, we have the question, why are we talking about physical benefits and not spiritual benefits? But nonetheless, the physical benefits indicate something special. Now then we go back, as he's going back now, to the very first words, walking in God's statutes. Now, chok is the word for a statute. And the word chukah relates to the word engrave, to engrave something. You've got letters that you can write, ink on paper or ink on parchment, and then you've got engraving on a stone or engraving on a precious stone.
Which is permanent.
Yes, it's permanent. You're quite right. The ink on parchment can be scratched off. You can scratch it off. Whereas the engraving in a stone becomes part of the stone, and that's another thing. Not only is it permanent, it's actually part of the very thing where you're engraving that. The engraving becomes part of that essence. Now, so at the top of this next page, page Vav, page 6, Shehu Inyan Otiyot HaChakika, the letters which are engraved, Hamu'uchadot, which are unified, Ba'atzmut or Ein Sof, with the essence of the radiance of the infinite. Now, here we have to have a little digression to understand, if you can share this with Helen maybe, and Maureen. Yeah, okay, and we'll share this. Now here we have a diagram of the Sfirot. So this is the central model, the central image in the Kabbalah. The idea that there are Sfirot flowing down, as it were. These are different levels of radiance flowing, and they come from the highest level, the infinite, Ein Sof. The infinite, Ein Sof in Hebrew literally means without end. And from that flows down at different levels. And then finally it comes down to the lowest level, which is kingship, fulfillment, the feminine, which leads to physical existence, the actual real world, reality. So there's this perspective on the nature of reality that it's brought into being by a flow which starts at a very exalted level. Right? Have you ever encountered this, Helen?
Yes, I think you mentioned something similar on a previous occasion. And it's interesting how such a hierarchy, a sequence of preferences given. And also, it goes both ways, look, and then converges again.
Yes. Yeah, now this is a very, very interesting idea. This is what the Zohar communicates in various ways, this model, this image.
The Zohar.
The Holy Zohar, yeah. The Zohar, word Zohar means light, and so it's the central book of the Kabbalistic tradition. And Zohar teaches many teachings on the whole Torah, but at the heart of it are the concept of these Sfirot, these divine attributes. So they're called Sfirot, which means something which expresses, like mesaper, like to tell, to speak. So the Sfirot, these emanations, they express godliness. And so this is a way of thinking about the way that godliness is being expressed from the infinite flowing down into our world.
And then why is the feminine at the very bottom?
Because that's the point at which everything becomes real. It's as if it's theoretical before then. And then it becomes reality. Like the relationship of the feminine and the masculine in the process of birth. That it's from the feminine that the child actually takes form and is then born as a real child. It's as if everything higher is just in a theoretical level, but without practical application.
And where would the masculine fit into this scheme of things?
Well, in a sense, this is the masculine, yes, flowing into the feminine. Now, the feminine can also be seen as having all these 10 dimensions as well. One can see that as being in the feminine as well. Here we're contracting it. But it's like the flow from above to below, from the male into the female. Because male and female reflect a spiritual reality which is on higher worlds.
You don't know what I'm thinking. I don't know whether I know what I'm thinking. Right.
Okay. Well, this is a very There are many different aspects to this idea of these divine emanations, and you know, we could speak about it for hours. But it's and the discourse doesn't address the difference between these qualities, you know, because that's another aspect that we're able to think about. Just, we are in the 7 weeks between Pesach and Shavuot, so there's the idea that each week we are perfecting one of these seven. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. The 7 lower ones that we are perfecting within ourselves. And this is the week of Yesod, dedication. So that's...
I was just going to add that these are concepts. They're abstract ideas. They're not literal. And that Ein Sof is a mixture of masculine, feminine. It's not...
Yeah, well, Ein Sof is beyond, yes.
And these things are beyond the... So how does kingship... Sorry to ask. How does kingship and feminine... How does that relationship work?
Well, it's in the sense that the feminine is like the reality of existence. Mm-hmm. It's like the joke. Someone says to a married man or married woman, who makes the decisions in your family? Oh, my husband decides all the important decisions and I decide the unimportant decisions. He decides who should be the president of America and whether the American embassy should be in Jerusalem and whether this and whether that. I decide where we live and which school we send the children to.
Mm. I'm used to tell that joke.
But this, I sort of feel that this implies that women don't have much to do with that.
In the modern age, let's say, there's been a new focus. I've just been marking essays that students have been writing in university. So one of the essays was about the role of the woman in Hasidism. So I've been marking essays on that this afternoon. And in the modern age, there's a lot of focus on women as scholars and studying Torah teachings on a very profound level and communicating Torah teachings on a very profound level. Whereas it is true that when we go to the early 20th century, the 19th century, women very often were left out of the education process. Now, in a traditional society, they had a tremendous spirituality and a deep wisdom, as we see from an extremely interesting 17th century autobiography written in Yiddish by a woman called Gluckel of Hamelin. And she wrote the story of her life, and you can see the most fascinating ideas in her head and very wide reading in Torah literature. Now, she might have been a rare example, or it might be that through her we see that there was a certain proportion of women who attained this kind of Torah knowledge. And there are traditions among the Kabbalists and the Hasidim, the Maharal of Prague, for example. So when he was going to get married, he was 14, something like that, and he met a 12-year-old girl, and it was agreed that they were going to get betrothed. So I think that was their ages. He gave her a syllabus, what to learn before she married him. And she became an extremely knowledgeable young lady, and she became his secretary. He wrote many, many books, and she would write them out and like put the references in, things like that. And I think it's said that 8 times she found where he'd made a mistake. He'd quoted something, but it was the wrong quote. She was able to put him right. In the Talmud, we have discussions between Rabbi Meir and his wife, Beruria, who seems to be more profound in her understanding of the direction of Torah than her husband, even though he's a very famous rabbi. and that, yet she's got a deeper perception. So it's you know, so it's a multiple subject, a very interesting multiple
subject. How many words were this essay, were these essays on feminism?
What?
So how long was the essay on feminism? Just
how long? Well, these were exam essays. So,
quite short.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's...
I'm interested to know what the sources are.
Okay, it's, I can give you my notes that I used to teach.
Tell you enough.
I can...
Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
See you a bit later.
Down.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's another point, is that at the top, you can see the word keter, crown. Keter, yes. Crown. So the crown connects with kingship. So there's a concept, Eshet Chayil Ateret Ba'ala. The woman of valor is a crown for her husband. So in fact, the fulfilled feminine is not just at the bottom of the list, she's at the top as well, or instead. And so that sense of being at the top and giving inspiration.
You are trying to reassure Nicole and me.
And
you.
Well, that's the tenor of Hasidic thought. That's particularly Chabad Hasidic thought.
You know, I'm concerned about something else. Is it all right to discuss this?
Yes.
These are very important notions, all of them.
Right.
However, one could find others,
right,
which to the superficial scholar would appear similarly important. And also, in other words, I don't see the justification of exactly these ones to be picked out. And also, I don't see the justification of the order in which they appear. Is there any explanation?
Well, in Tanya, part 4, chapter 15, there is a explanation of the meaning of these terms,
mm-hmm,
in relation to the communication process. And mm-hmm, because life is a process of communication or of teaching, and the relationship between husband and wife is also a communication process. And it's in terms of that the order of these qualities and the specific nature of these qualities has a particular relevance. Because at the beginning, if we look at the list, there's kindness that the person wants to give.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're trying to give, you maybe have to temper what you're giving in such a way that the person you're giving it to will be able to take it, will be able to receive it. For example, if you're trying to give wisdom, you're trying to give knowledge of mathematics, so you can't start at some very difficult concept which will be too much for the person to appreciate. So the kindness wants to give, and severity says, wait a minute, you've got to withhold. You've got to hold back. That's too much. Uh-huh.
So there is some and then, sort of balance.
That's right. Absolutely. Uh-huh. So that's a balance between kindness and severity, mm-hmm, which resolves in mercy, which is giving the right mix.
Right.
The right mix. Now, when you're giving, there are all kinds of adversities, problems that you have to deal with. In the whole process of giving, there might be a problem from within or a problem from outside, and you have to get over that problem on a simple level. If you're trying to teach something to someone, and outside there's someone making a noise, so how do you get over this problem? Can you shut the window? Can you move to another part of the building? How can you tell the person outside to stop making a noise? So that's an external problem. An internal problem is that as you're teaching, you suddenly get very depressed. You think, oh, this student's never going to understand. What's the point of my teaching this? We should just have a cooking class or something. Cooking, of course, now is a very sophisticated art which is taught, and cooking itself is something where all this process could apply. But so you have to get over that adversity. You have to have victory over adversity. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, a very important part of the communication process is submission, acceptance, listening to the other person. You can't give something to someone without listening to them, what they want and how they want it. And you've got to be able to appreciate that. In modern educational theory, they say, in the old days, teachers would talk all the time, you know, and students would make notes. Now they say the teacher shouldn't talk more than 35% of the time. The talking should be done by the pupils so that the teacher is able to evaluate what to say. And then when you have all that, then you've got dedication. Now, dedication is love. And the relationship with a student, to be able to give a student or the person one is communicating with, the deepest dimension of knowledge needs a focusing on that person with a sense of love and a sense of significance, recognizing the significance of that individual and being able to communicate. Mm. And through that you have fulfillment in terms of the whole process. That's my granddaughter. You're going to be my granddaughter. I forgot to tell her that you were going to be here because I hadn't managed to prepare the thing properly and she was reading it to me in the car. So hi, Monsieur, this is our cousin Helen.
Hello.
Helen Graham. So this is Monsieur Brackman who lives in Oxford.
Only the one that lives in Oxford to try to keep up with
where
they all come from.
Right.
Is she living with you?
During the week, because they go to school in London. So she and her sister and their cousin from Dublin, they live with us. Does that answer your question, Agnes?
At least it puts a kind of a structure over this, which is clearer than just the diagram in itself. Thank you.
Right.
Can I add something to the mix, which is a bit random? When we were talking about hook and hooking.
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking about engrave and statutes, it just made me think of the Ten Commandments.
Yes, absolutely. Because the Ten Commandments are engraved.
Mm-hmm.
And so that idea that in fact the Ten Commandments are engraved in our soul, they might sometimes get a bit covered up, like with dust, but they're always there. And so that's our deeper reality, that you're absolutely right, Rory. Yeah. Yeah. So here we're looking at it, that the engraving, the way it's described here, that the engraving is in the infinite, that it's as if the Torah teachings, these are the top two lines on page Rav, these profound teachings that we are studying and we are trying to absorb, which it says at the beginning, if you walk in my statutes, and Rashi says, if you make an effort in Torah study. And what it means here is that the Torah is really a dimension of the infinite. You see, the Kabbalistic and Hasidic way of looking at Torah is not that it's a book. It's really an expression of the divine, which at a certain level takes form as a book. But it's got higher and higher dimensions. And for us to study Torah, it's really we are grasping, we're trying to grasp the infinite, except that the infinite in most aspects of Torah seems to come down in a form that we're able to talk about it. It's a story. There's Jacob and Esau, there's Moses, there's Egypt, Mount Sinai. So they're like things that a five-year-old child can talk about or draw a picture in her book. But these things, each of these concepts is boundless in the most amazing way. I saw today a an article someone had written about Mount Sinai, like all the imagery about Mount Sinai and all the different things that it means on different levels. It's so fascinating. I think it wasn't an article, it was a book, a whole book on Mount Sinai. So there is so much to in the Torah. And so here it's talking about making the effort. So that's on line 3. V'telechu daika, walking, moving in our understanding of Torah. Hainu sheha avodahi ba'ofen shel alicha, which means that the way in which we study Torah is in a way of movement. Now, movement, Hasidic teachings put a very interesting interpretation to the word movement. Something can be moving with the same momentum. It means it's going at 40 miles an hour, but it's not changing. But to make it go at 60 miles an hour, you have to accelerate. So that's called movement. This word movement means not just moving at the same rate. It means accelerating. So the English way of translating the Hasidic understanding of the word halicha is accelerating. We have to accelerate. V'yadu shamitat inyan halicha hu ba'ofen shebe'ein aroch. Real acceleration is boundless. Going higher and higher and at an exponential rate increasing. And that's the way, that's our relationship with the Torah and our relationship with mitzvot. There's a kind of dynamic principle. In Hasidic thought, there's a kind of principle of dynamism, of this accelerating movement. It's very interesting in terms of the concept, whether Jewish tradition is about stasis or about dynamism. And one suggestion is that it's actually about dynamism. It's about a constant, fertile movement and discovery and going further and further, rather than some kind of static looking at the past, which is the way a person might imagine, oh, what is tradition? It's backward looking. Whereas another way of understanding it, on the contrary, the traditions of Judaism, particularly in the Kabbalistic and Hasidic streams of Jewish thought, are dynamic. They are dynamic. Val pizeh, and according to this, line 5, now line 6, mudgash yoteh achidush bedavar, we can see even more the special idea, shelamrot godel ma'alat ha'avodah, that despite this very intense spiritual service that we are carrying out for God, we're learning Torah in this accelerating way, and the Torah is so profound, and it's engraved in the infinite, it's ecstatic, it's amazing. And what are we told we'll get for it? Nitzkuru kan yehudim gashmim, physical things, sacha gashmi, physical reward. Even though surely if we're doing something so profound, it should be a spiritual reward first, and not a material reward. It should be something spiritual, not material. The Lord, and not only that, it only mentions the physical reward, doesn't talk about anything spiritual. Ve'ilu sachar ruchani lo nizka klal, a spiritual reward isn't mentioned at all. Gam lo bederech tefel, even if it would be just secondary. You know, you'll get rain and the crops will grow and you'll get some kind of spiritual damage. Now, then we have another question. So this is really that the whole time he's been spelling out this first question about the effort that we put in, which is described at the beginning of this sedra, results only in physical benefit, not in something more spiritual. And you could see, you know, it's as if Maimonides, the Rambam, you know, it doesn't really mean physical benefit. Why, you know, it's only there like giving a sweet to a child, you know, that kind of problem. Now then we have another thing. When we're looking at Rashi's comments, Rashi says, if you walk in my statutes, which we already said, if you accelerate in my statutes, in study of Torah, shetiyu amelim b'Torah, you should make an effort. Now, amal means a real effort. Amal daika. Now, there are lots of words for studying, but amal is like really a burdensome effort. Shezal derech maimer rabbeinu zal. This is like the sages say, kol adam la amal nivra. Man is created for work, for effort. And then the sages go on and they say, you know what? We're all created for effort. Very, very heavy effort. But the question is, what kind of effort? I don't know. Are we created for the effort of the mouth and the mind? That means Torah study and speaking Torah. Or physical work, plowing the ground. What kind of effort is it? It's some sort of effort. Whatever we're doing, it's going to be some kind of dynamic effort. And it could be in this dimension of life or in that dimension of life. And so it ends up, that passage from the sages say, you know what, we're created for effort, and hopefully the person will find a slot where it's the effort of Torah. And so that means so even more, why is it that through this effort in Torah study, all we get are physical things? Now, let's have a look now in what it says in the Shema in the Siddur, right? So here we've got the Shema in the Siddur.
Oh, Josh Gordon was saying, why was there such an increase, not immediately, but in the last years, in heart attacks?
Heart attacks,
heart
right.
Attacks and people. So what he said was, this was in his tenure today, he said, because once upon a time, he said, these days people say, ah, mitzvahs, it's not for me, but in my heart, I'm a Jew. He said, the problem is, he says, that Hashem created it, so the mitzvahs for all parts of our body, yes? And to concentrate it solely in the heart is just too much for the heart. And that's where we are today.
All right. All right, so the mitzvah for all limbs. All right, now let's have a look at this Shema. We have the second paragraph of the Shema. Do you see it? V'haya im Shema tishmu. Do you see that, Helen, where that is?
Yeah.
It will be, that's right. V'haya im Shema tishmu mitzvotai. It will be if you listen to my commandments. Asher anochi mitzaveh etchem hayom, which I command you today. La'avat Hashem et elokechem l'ovdo, to love God and to serve Him. B'chol levavchem v'chol nafshechem, with all your heart and all your soul. V'natati et ha'atzachem v'ito, then I will give the rain of your land in its time. Yore o'malkosh, the two different kinds of rain, the first rain, the later rain. V'asavta deganecha, and you will gather your crops. V'tiroshecha v'yitzharecha, and your wine and your oil. Right, and there'll be grass in the field for your animals and so on. So here too, we have a description of listening to God's commandments and God rewarding us with physical rewards. Okay, so this is, there's going to be some comparison with this here. Now, line 20. Just one second, sorry, it's not. Right, line 21. V'gam, the l'chora, at first sight, Hari mikra mele diber katov. The verse has already said clearly in this passage, which is in the Shema, v'hayim shemo tishmu, it will be if you listen to my commandments, and I will give you rain in its season. And there, Sha'av shelo nitzka inyan de amelim b'torah. There in the Shema, it doesn't mention making the effort. It just, im shamoa tishmu'u, if you listen, if you obey. So it's, you don't have to accelerate. In the Shema, it seems to be speaking about a kind of very normal situation. God gives commands, we keep the commands more or less, and we try to, and God gives us what we need. That seems to be what it's saying in the Shema. In our Sedra, it seems to be saying something else. It's saying if you make a real effort, if you accelerate, and you learn Torah in such a way that you know that it's something coming from the divine on an extraordinary level, So why is it that the result of what it says in our Sedra, which seems to be on a higher level altogether, is still only a practical reward, a physical reward? So we're contrasting what it says in the Sedra to what it says in the Shema. The Shema describes a relationship with God where we learn Torah, keep mitzvot, and we get a physical reward, but it's all like very gentle. It's our Sedra seems to express going more and more intensely, and nonetheless it still gives a physical reward rather than a spiritual one. So the real thrust of this discourse is about the whole nature of physicality and the whole nature of the physical things that come into the world, which we need, and the way in which these practical dimensions of life can actually be on the highest level of spirituality. And that is the profound teaching at the heart of the Torah, that the physical is really on a very exalted plane, even more than the apparent grandeur of the spiritual. So that's what it's moving towards. That's like the end of the story. That the reason why it emphasizes the physical is because of the exalted nature of physicality in God's relationship with us. And so therefore this intense relationship with God that is being described here in our Sedra is the way in which we get a kind of fulfilled physicality, which incorporates the spiritual within it at the same time. You don't have to make a distinction between the spiritual and the physical. It's all one because we're talking on a very exalted level. At a lower level, you can say, well, this is physical and that's spiritual. But if you're talking on a higher level, which comes about through our intensity in our relationship with God, and this effort that we make in the study of Torah and keeping of mitzvah, then we open a higher channel where the physical and the spiritual come together. That's basically, in a nutshell, the answer to the question that he's asking.
So does that mean that it's important to do physical as well as spiritual?
Yes. Yeah, the physical can be a vessel for the spiritual. We need to be able to have a balance so that we don't get lost in the physical dimension, but we also have to have the balance not to get lost in the spiritual dimension. But if we're plugged in the right way, then the two come together in a wholesome way. That's it.
Emphasizing all sorts of things that I don't understand. Emphasizing the physical, as the Sedra appears to, would give support to idleness, enjoying things without effort, rejoicing in the physical. It's a lukewarm existence without spirituality, and this is, if you wish to interpret it in this way, you could say, well, all right, God puts this in front of us in this way, I can just rejoice in the physical.
Well, and that, you see, a person would only take that route that you just described, Agnes, if they're taking the lower route in their perception of the physical.
Many people do that.
Well, so...
The majority of people, I should say, take that route.
Well, if they begin by making the effort in Torah study, accelerating, and studying Torah on a more intense level, not only the revealed part of the Torah, the more esoteric part of the Torah, then they're able to appreciate the physical in completely different terms.
Uh-huh.
And if, for example, all their physical needs are met, as it quotes at the end of the discourse, the Rambam says that in the time of Mashiach, everyone will be relaxed. All the like food and our physical necessities will all be supplied. Why? So that we can then focus our minds on the infinite oneness of the divine. And we can think about the greatness of God and see the wondrousness of God in all kinds of different ways. So the physical, the relaxing of the problems of the physical is in order to reach a higher expression of spirituality. But the Hasidic point which comes out is that in the physical itself is an ultimate level of holiness as well. So it's not running away from the physical.
Okay, here, I can try to interpret this in another way,
okay.
What we have just read.
Yes.
You walk in my statute, which is to say you keep to my laws.
Right.
That's what simply is what it means. Then I give you the rain at the right time, so that the flowers bloom and the fruit grows and everything else. And then you will be freed of much of the effort, because I help you with the growing of all this stuff. And you can then concentrate on learning and spiritualism. I can understand it in this way. Is that wrong?
No, I think that's a very good way to understand it.
Okay, so...
But then you can take it, next step, that through your learning, which becomes very intense, and reaches to a very exalted level, you perceive this physical around you in a new way. You see the physical as a convenience.
Okay, you can go on. So there you are. You are walking along the right route, according to my statutes. I give you all this kind of thing which goes for an easy life. It frees you from the pain of toil to some extent. You can then engage in spiritual life, and then you can create art to show how beautiful my nature was, because everything blooms according to the right time of the rain. So is this a possible?
Absolutely. Art is a beautiful expression in which the spiritual and the physical are united.
Right. They take on one from the other. It starts from you are being a good boy, walk according to my statute. Then there comes the physical, which is your reward. Then comes the spiritual, which allows you to move to a different sphere. And then you can link the two together in art.
Yes, yes, yes.
Is that
the Rebbe once wrote to an artist that in your art you are able to reveal the spiritual dimension which is there in physical reality.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Here is a beautiful flower or a beautiful
landscape,
if you wish, and you are able now to create art because you take a spiritual joy in this, because I freed you from toil, because you walked in my statute.
Yes, and the only thing is, it might be that it's the person's perception that he's freed from toil. Someone else looking at him might think, oh, he's got such a hard life, it's so difficult, he's been through the war and he's so poor and this and he's got an illness. But the person can have their own perception of life of where they see it in a different way. It's where they can see this promised being realized at that moment.
Yeah. All right. I can buy that.
Now, now the next section is where there is a discourse by the third Lubavitcher Rebbe called Rabbi Menachem Mendel, the Tzemach Tzedek. You see, there were seven Lubavitch leaders beginning around, you know, before 1800. 1772 was when Rabbi Dov Ber, the Maggid of Mezritch, passed away, and from then on, Rabbi Shneur Zalman, the founder of Chabad, he is like a leader, a very significant leader. And then you have, that's in the end of the 18th century, then you have coming down all the way through the 19th century and into the 20th century. And then our Rebbe, who's taught this discourse in 1966, he became Rebbe in 1950. You know, so it's like a chain of leaders. So each of them taught fascinating teachings, which is collected together in hundreds of books. It's a very, very fascinating teaching. And they link together. So our Rebbe is now discussing something that the third Chabad Rebbe spoke about in around 1850, and it's on this theme where he's taking a midrashic passage which says that panasa, earning a living, is greater than geula. Now, geula means redemption. Normally we talk about redemption as being the highest thing. And here there's this mysterious saying of the sages that panasa is higher than redemption. And what it comes out to is this idea of a more exalted way of looking at the whole process of getting panasa in the way that Agnes just mapped out, that one sees one's physical needs being sustained as a sort of expression of spirituality directly from the divine. In a sense, one step is redemption, and another step is seeing through one's redeemed self, one sees the physical world in a totally new way. And so the simple sustenance that the person has in order to live, and it moves on to the story of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. Now, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, he was a great sage who wrote the Zohar, the Holy Zohar, the central book of the Kabbalah, but he criticized the Romans. And as a result, the Romans wanted to kill him, and he and his son, they went and hid in a cave in the desert so that the Romans wouldn't catch them. And there was a miracle. A carob tree grew, and a spring of water suddenly appeared by the cave. That's how the sages put it. And they were able to live there for 12, 13 years. Now, that's the panasa. You see, that's the sustenance. The sustenance was it was very minimal in practical terms, but it was very spiritual, and that is the way that the sort of spiritual sustenance enables them to live and just the way they're living, it's as if it's directly from the divine. Now, this idea of something being directly from the divine, the discourse moves towards a position that we should be able to feel life as a kind of constant dialogue with the infinite, a dialogue with the divine. And so everything we have, and we need something, with the help of God, we get it, and it comes there. It's there. It's from the divine. But the discourse also has a very interesting additional point, that from the time of the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai, an important new principle was expressed. that in order for something to be really meaningful for us, it has to be something that we make an effort for. That if we don't make an effort, and we get it without an effort, as Agnes referred to just a minute ago, that people could become, if they have all the physical things they need, so they can become complacent and life becomes meaningless just because of the abundance of physical things. Mm-hmm. So we have the idea here, which is on a later page, page 10, that just through that we need this dimension of effort as well. Now, it's a spiritual effort.
Is it only spiritual effort, or is it physical as well?
Well, it can be physical as well. Im ein kemach, ein Torah. If there's no flour, then there's no Torah. And so, in order to get the Torah, you have to plow the field and grow the corn and gather it and grind it into wheat, and then grind it into flour. So that whole process. But the person is also doing that with a sense of total meaningfulness, that everything that they're doing is, as it were, as part of this divine circle of the spiritual and the physical being unified together. So that's basically this a basic insight into this teaching. Yes.
What is the justification of a lot of men concentrating on the spiritual, studying the Torah as their only occupation, while their wives are earning the living?